art, comedy, pop culture, and much more. You're listening to ACPN.
Hey guys, Podcast Rob here. And while you're listening to this week's episode, do me a favor and go over and check out QuixoticGames.com. That's Q-U-I-X-O-T-I-C Games.com. They're launching a Kickstarter that starts today, February 2nd, and is going to run through until February 25th. Now, what is that Kickstarter for, you may ask? Well, I'll tell you. It's for their two new games, Core World Empires, which is the epic standalone sequel to the original Core Worlds card game that was released 10 years ago, and Core Worlds Nemesis, which is a long-awaited solo expansion to the original Core Worlds card game. The campaign is going to include lots of cheap bundles, lots of add-ons, the original Core Worlds game and its expansions, as well as Dungeon Alliance series of games, which Quixotic also published. I've played a bunch of their games. I've helped them work on a bunch of their games. Definitely check out this QuixoticGames.com website. Annie Parks is a longtime friend, longtime supporter of the show. He puts out some great stuff. The original Core Worlds card game is a deck-building game. It's hella fun to play. Definitely check it out. Help support this awesome indie game designer and developer and these two new games. Check them out over at QuixoticGames.com. Once again, that's Q-U-I-X-O-T-I-C Games.com. Check it out.
Okay, here we go.
We can hijack your brain.
Something.
Okay, here we go. Welcome, everybody. It is time for the February edition of the Something Something Cast.
Something Something Cast.
Remix. What? What? James Atten.
Podcast Rob.
Hello, sir.
Hello. Hi.
Hey. So for those who are been paying attention for the 2021 season of the Something Something Cast, we've been trying to, when it's not this week's episode, the first of the week, we've been trying to like dive right into topic and not spending any time just jovially cavorting about things instead. Like, we'll save that for here. So how are you?
Good.
Cool. Let's get to the topic.
All right.
Teasing. No, we're taking on books this week, which is a while. It's been a long time coming. We don't do books enough.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And I mean, part of that is because I will freely admit I don't read as much as I probably should. I'm more of a visual guy. I'm more of a movie guy. I'm more of a TV guy. I'm not so much a book guy. When I do read books, it's books that, like, I know 100% before I dive into it, this is a book I want to read. It's very rarely a, let me see what this book is about. It's, right. You know what I mean? The last set of books, I'm more like sci-fi and fantasy sci-fi kind of stuff. So the last bunch of books that I read were the Horus Heresy series, Warhammer 40K lore, kind of how the Horus Heresy started and the prequel to that and how the Primarchs all, you know, came around and how chaos infected a bunch of the Space Marines and stuff. And it was like, I was like, oh, Horus Heresy, awesome, yes, give it to me, more. Right. So, like, I'd start buying them and I'd rip through, you know, each one of those books in like 2-3 days. Awesome. But then it very much started to feel like the Dragonlance series, where you had books that were the main storyline, and then you had books that were the tangent storyline, and then you had books of important things that happened during the Horus Heresy, but didn't have, like, they weren't integral to the main plot. You know, kind of like when you go to a Renaissance festival, the living chess game is always really cool, but it doesn't really, it's not a main story arc kind of thing, but it's important, so we're going to tell it to you. But you could go through the whole day without seeing it and not miss anything kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it's, hey, this is the same story you read in book three, but from somebody else's camera angle. And it just became, you know, like Riverwind the Plainsman was when I tapped out on Dragonlance. I think I got 17 books into the Horus Heresy, and they were like just getting over the crest of the halfway point. And I'm like, I'm tapping out. I gotta take a break. Gotta take a breather for a while.
As you say about Dragonlance, I'm going through my book collection as we speak because I'm trying to make more shelf space for other stuff because I've gone 90% digital as far as reading goes.
Right.
I'll go through stints of like, I've read 4 books this month and I feel very good about that, or 6 books. But then it'll be, all right, I haven't read a book in 3 months. I feel very illiterate.
Yeah.
But I cleared out my Dragonlance collection, just like you said. And I've probably read, I've read all of the ones I have that were written by Weiss and Hickman, because they are they're the mainstays.
Yep.
But I mean, I'm looking at a good 15 books that people gave me because they knew I like Dragonlance that I never read. Like,
right.
And it's because it's, you know, the second shift at Tavern of the Last Home. What happened that night? Like, what happened after the party left? And
yeah.
No, I don't care about Hedrick the Theocrat and Minos the Minotaur.
And I tend to reread books as opposed to read new books. So... like it was a yearly thing that I pretty much stopped once I moved about 2 years ago, just because I just didn't have the time when I normally did. But I would read the original 6, like the original trilogy and then the Twins trilogy, almost every year. I would, you know, I've read the Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, the 4-book trilogy 15 times each.
Sure.
Kind of thing. It's like when I'm in the mood to read a book, I'm like, I'm going to read this again, as opposed to... let me go find a new book and read it.
I have a couple of those. Hitchhikers I used to have, and it's gone. I lost it in a move, of which I've had thousands. I had a earmarked, highlighted, penciled in copy of the paperback Hitchhiker's Guide that, like, I had highlighted passages I loved and, like, wrote little notes for myself. And, like, it was just this beloved, broken, pages near falling out version of the paperback. I now have, you know, the big, mostly harmless tome. But I've read that one. I've probably read the most out of any book I've ever read. I think maybe the next is The Magicians, which I've read a few times because I just love that series. But that's, we are talking about some of the things that we've just discussed. We are talking about movies. But a very specific kind of movie that came from a book.
Yes. More importantly, movies, books that were turned into bad movies.
Yeah.
And you know, not to say that the books were bad. More that the movies were an amazing downgrade and just did not do the books justice in any way, shape, or form.
And I, when we first came up with the topic, like 2 or 3 sprouted up to me immediately. And then I had to start paring down because, you know, for as much as The Running Man isn't a great movie, I love The Running Man. But you know what? It's not really that great of a story either. It's not one of Stephen King's best. You know, so I was like, all right, that can't be on there. So these are definitely books that I love the book that the movie just didn't hold up.
Yeah.
So, where shall we start, my friend?
Well, we decided we're going to do our top 3 so it gives us a little bit more banter time for each entry, as opposed to like doing 7 or 10 or 12 or, you know, whatever wacky number we decide to roll on the old 20-sided die.
Day 4.
Exactly. So, why don't you kick us off?
All right.
You're the brain of this op.
Which is funny because I'm going to start off with the one I have probably the least amount to say about, and that's only because it's not really an exceptionally long book.
Okay.
That was turned into an exceptionally why movie. It's a kid's book.
Okay.
And it's a kid's book that I think nowadays, it's a book that I'd put in the hands of every child at some point in time on their journey through reading. Just because of how sort of delightful it is. The art is beautiful. The text has like 400 words in it, tops. And it was turned into a movie that makes absolutely no sense why it exists, except for kind of a good soundtrack. And that is Where the Wild Things Are.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it was done by Spike Jonze, who I generally like. He's done some great music videos, and he's great with visuals. So when they announced they were doing The Wild Things, I was of two thoughts. And that was, one, if anybody's going to make this look good, it's Spike Jonze. And the other was, but what is the movie going to be about? Because the book, the kid's book, Where the Wild Things Are, it's a kid who isn't happy, who goes into the woods, he meets some monsters, he's scared of them, he's not scared of them, he plays with them, he goes home. And I, in 50 words, have done what they do in 400 because they're much more beautiful. And it's charming and it's cute, but it's not a movie. And the movie proved that. I mean, it's just sort of dour. It's very beautiful. It's very CGI oriented, and it has the look of the creatures and whatnot, right? But it just doesn't capture the heart of the book in the way that I think Spike Jonze wanted to. Like I said, it has a really good soundtrack, and I think that's what sold it more than anything else. But it just, the whole movie feels sort of a downer. It doesn't feel joyous like the book does. And the book feels very fun and joyful. And, you know, when he leaves, it's because the wild rumpus has ended and he wants to go home and his parents are waiting and they love him. And this one is more about a kid who gets lost and he's sad and grumpy and it just doesn't jive. The whole thing.
Is this live action?
It's live action with CGI. Okay. It was probably 90% green screen.
Okay. Now, when you say CGI, are we talking like Roger Rabbit CGI animation, or are we talking like Jurassic Park CGI?
Closer to Jurassic Park.
Okay.
Yeah. It's much more of these giant 3D beasts. I mean, I can't say to how much the backgrounds were actual woods that they added creatures versus like, hey, green screen and we built a forest in front.
Sure.
It's just, I don't think the movie hit the emotion that the book does. And I think that's an important factor in a book to movie, especially for something so, number one, iconic nowadays. It's one of those books that you give kids. Like, I know I've given at least 2 or 3 copies of baby showers and stuff. It's a book I throw into a kid's hands because it's so different. And I would expect much more of a kid's movie. And what you get is much more of an independent, almost art film out of Where the Wild Things Are, the movie version. Everybody acts their part, and nothing about, like, it's not wooden or sucky like another one that'll be on my list. But, yeah, it just emotion, like watching it at the end, I went, well, that's time I spent.
Now, do you think that they were shooting for a translation of the book into a movie for people who, how can I phrase this? Do you think they were shooting more for the nostalgia of the people who read the book as kids and who were now an adult and wanted to see that kind of a movie? Or do you think they were shooting more for, hey, let's give kids who haven't read this movie yet a visual interpretation of it?
I think if it was anybody else other than somebody like Spike Jonze, I'd say it was probably, I want to interpret the book my way. Tim Burton.
Right.
But I want to say, I'm sure Spike Jonze had good intention of going, I want to get to the heart and I want to build my version of this story, but I want it to keep it thematically the same and visually the same. Because Spike Jonze, he's a very visual creator.
Right.
Like, it's all about the aesthetic and the way it looks. And it looks pretty. You can tell how much budget they threw at this thing. And I can throw up the wiki. They threw some budget at it. Well, it was $100 million. Box office, 100.1. So a success. Yeah. But I have to assume that he was going for, I want to make a movie in this world. And I want to make something that looks correct. I just think where it fell down was, I don't think it captured the joy. And Where the Wild Things Are has a lot of joy for me. It feels very indie, sort of stare at the camera. You know, the move that I move my match over here.
Right.
Did you kill the man? Yes. So yeah, there's my first one. Where the Wild Things Are. I got this one out of the way first because I feel like, I know there are people out there who really love the movie because it fits in that art house chic thing, but that's exactly the kind of movie I've more often than not sort of steered away from. And taking a kid's book and making an art house film just doesn't feel good.
Okay. Fair point.
What you got?
So my first, and maybe, again, this is kind of the weakest of the three, because you could argue that it's not a book, but a story. But I'm still going to list it on there because the difference between what was on the written page and what was on the silver screen was almost illegal, like how bad it was.
All right.
And unfortunately, this individual is no stranger to having bad movies made out of his works. The original story was called Trucks. The movie was called Maximum Overdrive. have yep. you've seen this movie, I would have to assume.
A long time ago, yes.
Yeah,
but...
yeah. The short story, actually, like, very tense, very creepy, very... it's got that typical kind of Stephen King ending, like, hey, it's an ending. It's not the ending that anybody wants. and it doesn't necessarily offer a huge glimmer of hope, but it's an ending, and it's where we're going to leave our story. Whereas the movie was just, it was just not good in any stretch of the imagination. Emilio Estevez starred in it alongside of the 18-wheeler with the Green Goblin's
giant
mug on the grill.
Yep.
And it was just... It kind of started not terrible, and then somewhere around the half hour, 40-minute mark just went off the fucking rails. Because in the movie, like, it is specifically trucks that have a problem. Like, it's never really explained as to why, I don't think. Mm-hmm. It's been so long since I've read actual story.
Couldn't speak to it.
But the movie, it's trucks, it's cars, it's hair dryers, it's lawnmowers, it's chainsaws, and I believe it was an alien intelligence that is just like taking over machinery to rid humanity from the earth, and it's just, what?
Now, number one, yeah, of course it's aliens. That's the go-to Stephen King, even in 1986. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is it that they turn on their owner? Like, they turn on people? Like, machines sort of...
Yeah, it's basically the robot overlords kind of take over.
Gotcha.
But it was... dumber than that. Okay, so you know, the trucks and the military vehicles and the 18-wheelers, you know, driving circles around the truck stop, keeping the humans inside terrorized and trapping them in there. And if they try to leave, they're running them over, or the military vehicles are shooting the M60 machine guns into the building, blowing them up. And then you've got this dude who's worked. Now, number one, kids, you don't work on the lawnmower when the spark plug cable is still connected. Number one, let's just get that out of the way. Number two, nobody works on a lawnmower. Just like typically you turn the lawnmower upside down or you turn the lawnmower on its side if you need to get underneath it. Nobody just tilts it up on its back wheels like it's doing a giant wheelie with the handle on the ground. Because I remember the scene, it's almost like the lawnmower kind of mentally possesses the dude. And like, okay, he's kneeling on the grass and he's like, no, no. But his hand is still reaching out to the lawnmower blade. Like he's trying to fight it. Like he's shaking. Like he's, you know, his hand is shaking from the strain. And the lawnmower blade is just going and going. And the guy's like, no. And then just like jams his hand in the lawnmower. And it's like, are you saying, sir, the lawnmower made you do that? Like,
right.
It was so utterly horrible. It was a $9 million budget and box office $7.4 million.
Whew.
Or, it states, $3.5 million in just North America.
Yeah, well. What? We could do a whole episode about King translations, and I don't know if you have any more King on yours.
I don't. That was the only one.
Because in the same year that... Do you know what other Stephen King story turn movie came out in this the same year as Maximum Overdrive, 1986?
It wasn't Pet Sematary, was it?
Was not.
Wait, 86.
86. That's when it seems Silver Bullet? Document. No.
I don't know then.
Stand By Me.
Okay.
Which, like, by and large, is a beloved film. I don't know if you are a fan. I'm a big fan.
I will be honest. I didn't know that was a Stephen King movie. So there you go. Yeah. Go ahead. Hate me for
came
that.
Came from the same set of series that Running Man did, and maybe Lawnmower Man.
Okay.
But that said, like, Stephen King has two different types of movies. And I think 1986's Maximum Overdrive versus Stand By Me is like the quintessential showing of this is what happens when you get Stephen King right. This is what happens when you get Stephen King wrong.
This is what happens when you get Stephen King wrong.
Whew. Is Maximum Overdrive so good? Is it? All right, I'll ask this. Yeah. I'll ask this about what you think for me.
Okay.
Would I enjoy watching Maximum Overdrive for how bad / good bad it is? Is there enjoyment to be had in its dumb?
God, it's been so long since I've seen the movie.
Fair enough.
I don't know if there is an enjoyable amount of stupid in it. Then again, you have to realize that you and I were both at some of our movie nights that we did where we watched such gems as Hard to Kill. Right. And there was no joy in Mudtown on that movie either. I would say maybe if you ever decided to listen to one of our episodes and you listened to this one and then went and watched Maximum Overdrive, there might be some kind of enjoyment in it because you could be like, yes, I now understand why it's so shitty. But right. Just to say, I want to watch a bad movie. Let's watch Maximum Overdrive. You may very well just end up regretting your choice regardless.
I think the only way I can justify it is if I make like an Emilio Estevez movie night. So it was like this and then Free Jack.
Isn't that the one with Rolling Stones guy?
Yep.
Free Jack? Yeah, yeah.
Yes, where like there's body swapping in the Day After Tomorrow future. It's wonderful.
Good stuff.
All right, let me take to my next one. My next one is another one of those books that's become beloved by a lot of fantasy readers. Also, somewhat of a kid's book, although I put this one older. It's young adult. It got a movie, and it also has now a TV series. So the thing about the book is that it does a lot of, I'm not going to tell you what's going on. I'm going to show, not tell. So the story starts and you're in a weird world and it's sort of like our world, but there's shit that's weird. There are like Pokemon running around everywhere and it feels sort of, you don't know the technology level of the world. It's Earth, but it's not Earth and you can't figure out why. So, but it's got these wonderful set pieces and moments that you think are going to make great movie.
Clearly so did they.
Yes. And to do so, they got an amazing cast together, and they dedicated, because the movie came out right in the Harry Potter range, where like every young adult book is getting a treatment. And they got this great cast together, and they gave you a movie that didn't feel comfortable leaving things to show and not tell. So they told, and they told, and they told. And if there was a new word, they paused and almost looked at the damn camera to go, that word means this. And it is The Golden Compass, which now has a TV series on one of the pay channels, I want to say HBO, that is excellent and doing things so much better. The Golden Compass movie, which I enjoy from a visual perspective, and I think I said the same thing about where the wild things are, and how come I didn't pull up data on Golden Compass? I'm a big stupid head.
Because you're terrible.
Yeah, I really am. The Golden Compass is... it's the story of a young girl in an alternate world, but it's also sort of an anti-story to Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. There's a very... I don't want to say anti-religious, because it's not anti-religious, but it is a very soul discussion book. You'll find that a lot of private schools and Catholic schools don't allow it. It's not even allowed to be read because it has, you know, Adam and Eve were real people, and this soul is this physical manifestation. It's midichlorians kind of thing. And for these people on this particular earth, their soul is embodied in this cute little fuzzy animal, and your animal can change shapes until you hit puberty, and that sort of locks in to the animal that is your soul. So if you meet people with the soul that is a snake, well, they probably have the soul of a snake. The movie at the very beginning can't help but just have this beginning opening adventure of the main character, whose name's Lyra, running around with her daemon, whose name is Pantalaimon. It has to go, we live in a world different than the world you might be familiar with. We have creatures that follow us around called daemons, and they are tethered to each other. They are tethered to us, and you may never touch another person's daemon. It is the height of rudeness. And all of these things come out in the plot in very uncomfortable ways in the book. So, that said, throughout the book, there's a polar bear fight. And this polar bear wears, gigantic golden armor. And he comes out and he has this huge battle. There's a fight between two daemons. There's... this evil factory where kids are having their souls severed from them. It's all very dark. It's a very dark young adult book. And the book does it in such a way that while you're reading it, you're supposed to feel uncomfortable. And the end of the book is bad. At the end of the book, you really, you want to reach for the second book because nothing good has happened in the last 30 pages. And it ain't getting better. The end of the movie, because the studio wasn't sure whether or not they were going to do a second one, they made sure the ending has sort of a positive, happy note, which at the beginning of the second book, they sort of reveal the twist at the beginning of the second book at the same time as go, but it's okay, when it's so not. The cast in this film, we have Daniel Craig, we have Nicole Kidman, who is phenomenal, Ian McKellen, Ava Green, there's actors, Christopher Lee, Sam Elliott, who is perfectly cast, FYI. Sam Elliott is the one perfect casting in that film. But it just was all... it was taking the Harry Potter thing and just not trusting your audience to be smart enough to understand a deeper concept.
Right.
It would be like when the Pensieves get to Narnia, they're like, hey, look at that lion. He's like Jesus. Huh.
Huh. You don't say.
So there we go. That is my second one, The Golden Compass. I'm enjoying the HBO series. I'm looking forward to season 2. I highly recommend for those... who like their young adult books to be dark and fuck it up. I highly recommend the trilogy. The second book's a little hard to get through, but the third one tears at your heartstrings and rips you asunder. So,
and who doesn't want to have their heartstrings ripped asunder?
I ask for that in a book.
Fair
enough. Desire it. What you got for number two?
So my second one was, it was a book that I really liked, and it's from an author that we have touched upon many years ago in the early days of our podcast. The book I really liked, the book kind of took the world by storm. The movie, not great. I'm sure there are people who liked the movie, I am not one of those people. And the original casting for the movie was questionable at the time. I'm referring to the book that pretty much put Dan Brown on the map for the most part, The Da Vinci Code. Now, the book I really liked. As much as we joke about Dan Brown being very cookie cutter in his means of storytelling, which I still stand by that to this day.
Yeah, of course.
The book was still, for what it was, well woven. Mm-hmm. The embellishments that were made and the changes to fit his story were well done, and the kind of sleuthing and detectiveness of it, I thought was pretty well paced. You lose all of that in the movie, and I don't know if it was because of time or tedium, but every, like in the book, it you feel like there is pressure. There's a sense of urgency. There's you know, fuck, we only have five guesses at this and we've used four of them already. We can't be wrong on this last one. Whereas right. in the movie, it's, well, what if we try that? Oh, hey, that worked. That's pretty cool. And like every time they come to a crossroads where they have to figure something out, like it is always miraculously the first thing that they try. Wow, that was the first thing we tried. And it's just like you lose all sense of struggle, all sense of, you know, when you're trying to figure out a riddle or a puzzle and you just beat your head against a wall for weeks and then all of a sudden you have that aha moment and it's rewarding. It's not rewarding when everything you try is right the first time. You know, there was no hill that you climbed for it.
Right. To that point, I think there's one thing about the book that the thing I really liked about Dan Brown's books is that for as much as there's fantasticalness to the narratives, like, yeah, we know it's not really the Holy Grail thing. His inner monologue is based in enough fact to see how you got from point A to point B.
Sure.
Well, you know, the Egyptians hold their spears in the left hand, which is where we got the word sinister, which is, you know, he goes through some sort of weird etymology that has truth to it. So that means we hit the left button, and you hit the button and you're like, oh, it worked. Cool. They don't get to do that in the movie.
No, not at all.
Can we discuss who they got to play him?
Oh, yeah, Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And that was the casting. When the minute they said that, people was like, okay?
Yeah. I mean, our Dan Brown episode is in the first dozen of our episodes, and even back then I think we were like, he's a bit old, isn't he? And that was then.
I don't even think it was the age thing. It's just I don't think when a movie becomes popular, I'm not going to say good, but when it becomes popular, mm-hmm. that becomes the, I'll say, standard. So I had read the Da Vinci Code book and seen the Da Vinci Code movie before I read Angels and Demons. Once you see the Da Vinci Code movie, you cannot read Angels and Demons or Inferno and not picture in your mind's brain that this is Tom Hanks running around doing all of these things. So it's one of those things where it doesn't matter how good or bad the casting was, that has now set the tone. So anybody who watches a Da Vinci Code movie or Angels and Demons or Inferno and then says, well, let me read these other books that this guy's written. You, the minute it says Robert Langdon, you're just like, oh, you mean Tom Hanks. And it's just like you're kind of stuck with it that way.
No, you're right. And he doesn't fit my brain for who I saw Langdon as. Won't lie.
No, I don't think he fit anybody's brain, and that was the problem.
And because it was a Ron Howard film, wasn't it?
I believe it was.
Which
Da Vinci Code? Yes, directed by Ron Howard.
I mean, and Tom Hanks and Ron Howard are good friends. They've done a bunch of films together. So I understand why Ron Howard chose him. He's big budget at the box office. At the time, he was one of the top five actors in the world. Like, I got why they did it. But it feels like there was somebody should have been like, Ron, don't call your friend on this one. You could get a guy. We could have a moment where you introduce the world to somebody badass.
And I mean, if a studio were to come to you and say, look, we're going to give you $125 million. We're going to give you Tom Hanks, Ian McKellen, Alfred Molina, Jürgen Prochnow, Paul Bettany, and Jan Reno. Make a movie. You're like, fucking A, yes, this is amazing.
Right.
I mean, budget was 125, box office was 760, so it made its money. It just was not a great movie.
No, not at all. Did they do this? They did a sequel, didn't they?
I mean, they did Angels and Demons, and they did Inferno. I didn't even know they had turned Inferno into a movie, but
no,
apparently
nor did
they
I.
did. So now I'm gonna have to hunt that one down.
I'm hearing movie night.
Quite possible.
Mm-hmm.
On the worst movies of 2006 episode of the television show Ebert and Roper on January 13th, 2007, guest critic Michael Phillips listed the film at number 2 of the worst movies of 2006. The film earned a Razzie nomination for Howard as worst director, but lost to M. Night Shyamalan for Lady in the Water.
Ah, another fan favorite of ours.
Yeah. 26% on Rotten Tomatoes, 4.8 out of 10 on Metacritic.
Now, to the movie's defense, barely, to the barest of defenses, I don't know if they had gotten the perfect guy to play Robert Langdon, and let's say it was Matthew McConaughey or somebody like that, like they got the right big name actor. He was always how I imagined it.
Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah, I always imagined Matthew McConaughey as Robert Langdon in my head. Yeah. That said, I don't know, even if the movie was perfectly cast and perfectly scripted and perfectly plotted, that it wouldn't have still had the ring of problem, because by the time the movie came out, and there was a good chunk of years between book and movie, the excitement on the story and the Dan Brownness had settled, and people are like, ah, it's not really history and nobody should believe this tripe and now you and I have discussed this. It's fiction. It's fun. We know it's not real. Shut up. I just don't know whether that movie ever would have been made and been beloved, because even though it's, you know, National Treasure or Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, even though it's the same general archetype film, there was this weird sort of, we don't like it because it isn't real or something. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
No, absolutely. Yeah. It was part of the whole... It was part of the whole, I'll say, blowback when the Da Vinci Code got super popular, that, you know, you had these people who read it, and I don't know, questioning isn't the right term, but they believed what they read, because he does a better than decent job of taking things that are factual and weaving them into things that he's creating in a believable way.
Right.
To make people who are the type of people that just read the headline of an article without reading the article go, oh my God, I didn't know that's how it was. That's not how it is. But now you think it is. So that's now your preconception of it. The blowback was in full force by the time this movie came out, that no, it's not really, that's not a thing. He made all that up, but I read it. Yes. In the book that he wrote, you read it. That doesn't mean, you know, it's in the fiction section. It's not. So there was some, there was some negativity about the movie, not only for the casting, but like you said, for the whole, but why are so many people into it? It's not real.
Yeah. My favorite point to make to people who are like that are to remind them that at the beginning of Night of the Living Dead, it says inspired by true events.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there you go.
Exactly.
So we're going to jump up to my big one. My one that, which is funny, I'm looking at all mine. They're all, and I didn't realize it when I wrote my list, they're all sort of young adult books. This one was one that, again, happened around that Harry Potter range of time, and people were really into taking young adult fiction and turning it into things. And this one was one that I was probably, let me see, the movie on this one came out 2006. The book came out in 2002. So it was a short run. And like the minute this book hit the stands, the minute like the sequel was in the works, the writer was receiving checks. Because it had a really interesting story behind how the book came to be. It is Aragon by Christopher Paolini.
Mm-hmm.
The writer of the book was like 15, 16 when he started shopping it around. And now I can say from personal experience that shopping around a book is a fucking nightmare.
Is it?
It is. Trio is available on Amazon Kindle by James Hatton. So, but I was super into the idea of a 16-year-old who wrote a fantasy novel. So I bought it and I really enjoyed it. Let's address the problem with the book before we get to the movie. The book is written by a 16-year-old who is at the age of 16, and I'm sure yours is similar to mine. We've drunk in like Dragonlance and Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and all these sort of fantasy elements and maybe a little Lovecraft. And so we have this brained knowledge of what fantasy is. Dwarves work in mountains and elves live in trees and they're sort of snooty and it's just sort of the atypical fantasy that we come to know and love. So a 16-year-old wrote a book about a boy who finds a dragon egg and gets involved in a war about the missing dragons. And the lord of the world is named Galbatorix, and he's this evil overlord guy who's sort of like Sauron because he's been around forever. And the elves are pretty, and the dwarves will live in mountains. So it's very atypical. But what's interesting is over the course of the series of books, you get to see him evolve as a writer. To the point where at the end of the third book, you're like, oh my God, how's it going to end? And you get to the end of the book and he goes, I'm so sorry. This book doesn't end here. I had too much to write. So there's going to be a fourth book, even though it was supposed to be a trilogy. My original first edition print says of the blah, blah, blah trilogy.
Right.
And it was okay because the fourth book is going to, he's really gotten so deep into these characters and evolved his world that in book one, elves are pretty and dwarves live in mountains. But now, like, they have an interesting political structure and the elves aren't long lived for the reasons you think they are. He built on his own. But it didn't get that far because most people only saw the movie, which as Lord of the Rings was coming out. 2006 is around the same time and Harry Potter and etc. It was, let's get this shit out there while we have some fantasy money, plus this kid's hot shit. Anybody in the fantasy, like, world, in the young adult fiction world was talking about Aragon and the inheritance stories. The movie, though, is so bad. So bad. I love the riff tracks of it because that's the type of thing I enjoy watching. It has this amazing cast of people who, when they're good, they're great. But when they're bad, oh, they're in a lot. Let me pull up the IMDb. Oh, I pulled up the wiki, not the IMDb, but let me get that up because I can give you a quicker list of all of the actors and actresses that are in this film. And you'll understand exactly what I'm saying about like when they're good, they're great. But Jeremy Irons I think, is a perfect example of a guy who's been in a lot of things that people see as good films, or in it, he plays interesting characters. Mm-hmm. But then when it's a really shitty movie, it's not a shock that Jeremy Irons is in it. He's like Rucker Hauer. Like, Rucker Hauer's in a couple bangers, but when you see a bad movie, you're like, oh, it's the Rucker Hauer movie.
Yeah.
John Malkovich, which was in a crazy choice, plays the villain. So, what? Oh, not surprising?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when he's acting, he's great. But when he's overacting, you know he's there for the paycheck.
Right.
And the CGI in this is worse than Dragonheart. And Dragonheart came out like 10 years before it. The rules, they sort of meld around, they like blur around the rules of the world because they weren't completely formed, because the movie only came out 3 years after the book. So he didn't even have time to fix the problems he had from the book,
right,
of which there were some. So like, oh, the dragon is your spirit. No, wait, the dragon chooses the rider. No, magic comes from within. No, your dragon provides you the magic. No, the magic is in the friends you made along the way. There are twists that happen in book three that I know Christopher Paolini didn't have in his head when he wrote the first book that
right.
fit. He smartly, he went back and he looked at his material and goes, oh my God, I can make this fit. I can make Darth Luke's father, and other than one weird kiss, it's cool. So in the movie, none of that subtext is there, and it makes no sense, especially if you know, like, no, that's not going to work. Where's Tom Bombadil when you need him? So, Aragorn is a horrible movie. It did, let me see here, had a budget of $100 million. It made $250 million, which would qualify as, I would say, a success for something so sort of untested. But by and large, I'm sure it also won a bunch of Razzies. It has a 16% on Rotten Tomatoes. Aragorn is a fantasy epic that lacks any magic, brought down to earth by unconvincing world building and a litany of stars who seem bemused by the material. And I'll tell you, it's true. Every one of the actors that aren't sort of young, because there's a bunch of young actors in it, who are just sort of getting their feet wet. Every one of the Jeremy Ironses of the film, you can see they're like, ah, yes, a dragon. Look to your left, there is a dragon. It's very over the top. They chew on the scenery the minute they walk into frame. Highly recommend the movie for how bad it is, but sadly, it doesn't. It does the book justice because a 16-year-old wrote it, but that's unfair because a 16-year-old wrote it.
Right.
So yeah, Aragorn.
It really did want to try to cash in on that whole Harry Potter craze that was going around. Because I remember, you know, everybody was saying that was going to be the next big thing. That was the next big Harry Potter thing.
Yeah. There was a few of them in the same way that, like, there was a bunch of teen girls going on dystopian future adventures after Hunger Games.
Right.
Young boy makes good in fantasy land. You know, Percy Jackson and the like. And I'm not shitting on Percy Jackson. They're fun books. I've read a few of them. But yeah, it was very much a, get it out there! We have Potter money to make! You didn't happen to see that, Aragorn, have you?
I did not, nor did I read the book.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't expect you to have read the book. It sort of came and went if you weren't paying attention. I do, for any fantasy readers out there, take the first book with a grain of salt, but it's an interesting journey because they progressively get better as you watch him become a better writer or have money for a better editor. Last point, Trio by James Hatton, available on Amazon. Back to you.
So, this last movie that I have listed is a book that I greatly enjoy. Part of the book spawned the name for a very popular rap group years ago. The movie was so bad that they ended up making a movie about making the movie. I am referring to 1996's The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Oh! Yes!
This movie is absolutely horrible.
I think it should go without saying, I absolutely love The Island of Dr. Moreau.
You, my friend, have more issues than National Geographic. This movie was terrible. Marlon Brando, Val Kilmer, David Thewlis, Fairuza Balk. Now, I love me some Val Kilmer. I love me some Fairuza Balk. Brando's Brando. How bad could this movie... This movie is...
It's so bad!
This movie is used diaper tempura bad. This movie is budgeted $40 million, made $49 million. I don't even know how it made that much. This movie is so bad that they got rid of the original director of the movie and brought in John Frankenheimer and told the original director, we'll give you your entire salary if you just kind of quietly go away and just don't
please stop.
Don't speak of this ever again. excuse me. Brando wore a small radio receiver to help him remember his lines. Which was picking up random local radio chatter. Co-star David Thewlis would claim he'd be in the middle of a scene and suddenly he'd say, there's a robbery at Woolworth's, thinking that was his line because he was picking up police radio chatter from nearby.
Mr. Brando, we are currently at the craft services table.
Yeah, exactly. Fairuza Balk stormed off set after getting into a huge argument with New Line, and one of their operatives basically pulled her aside and said, they will ruin you, and you will never work in Hollywood again if you don't honor your contract and get back on set. And she finally did. It's just, it's absolutely horrible. If you've seen the movie and you've seen him like wearing the whole like white bedsheet thing with the white Noxzema face full of makeup and the white, it's, I don't understand what, I just don't understand.
Did you see the documentary?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. The documentary, 1,000 times better than the actual movie.
Yeah. For those not in the know, it is Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau. And as a companion piece to the film, it is amazing.
It is, so if you are going to say, you know what, this sounds interesting, I want to see how bad this movie is, please, I beg of you, dear listener, get a copy of Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau, along with the movie The Island of Dr. Moreau. Do not watch one without immediately watching the documentary afterwards, because... it's kind of like a salve. It's kind of like eating a giant spoonful of sour cream after mistaking the Scotch bonnet for a chocolate-covered strawberry. The movie itself is so terrible, and the documentary, like, it rips the Band-Aid off how terrible it is to show you that it was even worse than you could have possibly fucking imagined.
Right.
The shit that you didn't see.
If it was bad for the viewer, think how bad it was for us, the actors.
Yeah. As a mild tease, the movie that we saw, it was version 4.2 of the script that was written. Because there were so many different original people cast and versions of the script written that then this piece changed out and this person said, well, if they're not doing it, I'm not going to do it. And then this fell apart. And then, but this person's coming in. So 3 new people came in. Oh, but she's in it. No, I'm not going to be part. And then everybody left. It's just, it is like the ultimate nightmare of making this movie. And it shows in the finished product.
add in that this is Brando at his end when he wasn't in the best of health, but there was a contract and there was necessary money needed.
And he was also mentally recovering from his daughter's suicide at the time, too. So there were quite a few reasons that he was just not with it.
He didn't care. He didn't want to be there. He was quite distracted. And also he knew that they needed him. So like he just pulled rank and did whatever the fuck he wanted because he's Brando. Oh,
I think one of the favorite things that came from that documentary, I believe, is they're talking to Fairuza Balk about it, and they're supposed to go on set to do one of their scenes, and Brando didn't want to do that particular scene. He wanted to film a different scene, and he was pulling, you know, he was swinging his Brando dick around, and they were like, okay. And Fairuza Balk goes to him, she goes, but I didn't learn my lines for this scene. And he basically said, nobody's going to fucking watch this movie anywhere, dear. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, okay. Got it. And action. Mm-hmm. It was just an absolute horrible fucking movie.
Great
so
call.
Yeah, so that's my third one. What do you have any honorable mentions real quick?
I do have two that I didn't want to go too depthful in because they are usually my stand on my pulpit and scream movies. So I'll just mention them because they deserve to be mentioned. The Willy Wonka and the Alice in Wonderland made by Tim Burton are the worst possible effing things put to cinema. Tim Burton should not be allowed in your children's books, and he ruins everything I love.
Okay.
Yeah, that was... It's just that his Alice in the Wonderland is a very odd interpretation, and it features a very Johnny Depp centric film because they had him and they wanted to use him. Hey, and hey, look, also Helena Bonham Carter. And then we move over to Willy Wonka it's a Johnny Depp centric film. And oh, look, there's Helena Bonham Carter. Neither of them feel very oriented towards the books that they were written about. And they both feel very much like Tim Burton going, I want to be Tim Burton and I'm weird. And look at the money Disney gives me to be weird. And they in no way have the heart of the books in mind. And so, yeah, they both are my honorables because, part of it is because Willy Wonka is the original, the Gene Wilder is one of my favorite films of all time. And I loved the books growing up, although rereading them as a child or rereading them as an adult, which I did about 2 years ago. There is some uncomfortableness. The Great Glass Elevator has not aged well. There is some racial issues in that book, but the books have a very specific place in my heart, as well as the movie, and seeing Tim Burton just go stripe on it, which is the term for what happens when Tim Burton fucks up something you love, he goes stripe.
Right.
Those are my honorable mentions because they always will be. What you got?
I have two quick ones. One of them, they made some minor changes to that I wasn't crazy about. It was Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Wasn't crazy about how they altered the ending. Not only was Voldemort's death not as impactful as it was in the book, where regardless of how he wanted to be immortal, he died as a human, which the movie kind of got away from, where he kind of like dissolved into dust weirdly. Mm-hmm. And then the whole snapping of the Elder Wand was just like, what? Just, yeah, not very good. And then the other one, I put it on here because it's a book that we love, and it's a book that you actually mentioned, that we mentioned kind of getting into this whole thing. It's Ooh. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the movie.
Ah, okay.
I wanted to like it. I really did. I like the cast. I was okay with the cast. But the way they pulled it off was not good, and the only reason it's an honorable mention is because as bad as the movie is and as divergent as the movie is from the book, it's on brand for Hitchhikers because yes. every iteration of Hitchhikers was different than the iteration before, from the radio drama to the book to the TV show. Everything had its own differentness that they changed about it for each new iteration. So I'm not 100% like I get it, you know, whether it was intentional or not, it fits the mold of the previous Hitchhiker versions. I wanted to like it more than I did, and I loved the book, and I didn't like the movie at all.
To your point, I thought about Hitchhikers in my head quite a bit. I really thought, but your reasoning is the exact same reasoning I came to, that there are so many different versions of the Hitchhiker story, all done by Douglas Adams or people sanctioned by Douglas Adams' estate, that I have to accept them all for being their thing. I'm super with you. And right. Great call.
So that's that.
Yep. On the other point, no matter what your thoughts are, people collectively listening, your thoughts are on Rowling. Just putting that out there. I didn't like the last book either. So I barely remember that there are major differences between the end of the series.
I had my own take on how the series was going to end. I'm not upset with how it ended in her book, but it's not how I would have ended it. I had two different thoughts in mind of how it was going to end. That's a whole episode, an entire 100%. Episode for a completely other day. But I had two different versions, both of them wildly different, and neither one of them were the way it actually ended. But when you get something that's that popular, that becomes that much of a pop culture and social bonfire, so to speak. I mean, it just went gangbusters. You're never going to come up with an ending that's going to make everybody happy.
Of course not.
So, I mean, it is what it is. It's the ending that she decided she wanted for her stories. And great. Cool. That's, you know, I'm okay with it. Again, I had two other endings that I thought they were going to go. Neither one of them did. But what are you going to do?
And with that, I ask you, everybody out there in something land, are there any books that you love that got really bad movies? Are there any books that were really bad that got even worse movies? Let us know in the comments, whether it be on the Facebook, on the Twitter, or any of those things that you can find at somethingcast.com. Right at the top bar, you can find all the links and widgets to the places that we know and love. Also, we would love some feedback as to what you think of some of the new website features, including, have you tried listening to an episode on the website? Because that shit's baller. Let us know anything and all things.
That shit's baller.
I mean, I know the guy who put it on the website. I
know absolutely, the guy yeah, we in. Know a guy.
I mean,
he's sexy. Check it out, somethingcast.com. New year, new website. Let us know what you think. Hit us up on the Facebook or the Twitter or the Gmail. All places something can be found on somethingcast.com.
Damn right. And Rob's been going back on the Twitch to stream some games, and I'll be joining him sometime in the near future to get back into that as well.
Absolutely. So and if you are listening to this episode, know that this episode, even though we are recording it at some secret location at some point in time, it will be airing. You will be listening to this, dear listeners. It will be gracing your eardrums on February 2nd, which is a Tuesday, meaning at the time you are hearing my amazing voice in this episode, 8 o'clock tonight, you can go to our Twitch at twitch.tv/somethingsomethingcast, and you can watch us as we record another episode and then play some Jackbox games afterwards. So definitely follow us on the Twitch, twitch.tv/somethingsomethingcast. Come watch us play Dead by Daylight, watch us play Rocket League, watch us play Minecraft, watch us record a podcast episode. Just watch us, please.
Please. God, please.
We need attention.
With that said, thank you all for joining us. We will see you next time. I'm James Hatton.
I'm Podcast Rob.
See you guys in the movies.
Later.
Something, something, something.
Okay, here we go.